Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, American reporting on Iraq often leaves one with the impression that things will work out, at least for the White House, if officials can just pull off another election or train more Iraqi security forces. Veteran Iraq reporter Patrick Coburn of the London-based Independent newspaper doesn't see it that way. He'll join us to discuss Iraq coverage. Also on the show, according to a New York Times editorial, quote, just as Hurricane Katrina forced Americans to look at the face of lingering poverty and racism, this mining tragedy should focus us all on another forgotten, mistreated corner of society, close quote. Of course, the paper's narrow definition of Americans and their presentation of wide swaths of the population almost as one of their neediest cases says all by itself a tremendous amount about why we won't, in all likelihood, see serious attention to the dangers faced by workers in Sago or anywhere else, at least not in the pages of the corporate press. We'll hear from journalist Brian Dominick of the website The New Standard about what lessons media could take from the Sago mine story. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
As with racism and poverty after Hurricane Katrina, some reporters appear to be newly discovering anti-worker bias in the wake of the Sago mine disaster. Sadly, we don't predict this conversation will go much further than that one did, given that the anti-worker perspective of corporate news media at this point seems so ingrained as to be almost offhand. For a January 8th segment on ABC's This Week, George Will spoke to Rick Wagoner, the CEO of General Motors, grilling Wagoner on why the world's largest car company might face bankruptcy. Will contended that people who buy GM cars are, quote, paying a lot of money for a welfare state that you're running. Someone recently said you buy a Hyundai, they give you a satellite radio. You buy a General Motors car or Ford, you're buying pensions, medical care, and all the rest. Adds an enormous premium on the cost of a car, close quote. Will must surely understand that health and retirement benefits aren't charity, but a key part of the contract workers negotiate with management to compensate their labor, and that in many places where companies don't cover those costs, the state does. Not an arrangement Will is famous for endorsing. So it certainly seems as though Will is advising GM to break the deal it's made with its employees that allows them to see a doctor and retire before they die. And he seems surprised that Wagner doesn't take the advice as blithely as he offers it. Over on NBC Nightly News the following night, reporter Ann Thompson was equally matter-of-fact, if less venomous. A segment about new cars that touched on domestic automaker woes included a brief exchange with Bill Ford of Ford Motor Company. Thompson had just one question. It was about job cuts, which she described as dramatic, that are expected later this month at Ford. Quote, will your cuts go deep enough? Close quote. Media outlets officially deny any bias against working people, of course, but coverage that rhetorically tosses workers aside without a thought tells a different story.
Bill O'Reilly has never been shy about attacking his perceived enemies, but on the January 2nd O'Reilly Factor, the Fox pundit took his rhetoric to a startling level. In his Talking Points memo segment, O'Reilly issued threats against individuals at the New York Times in retaliation for their coverage of Bush, singling out Bill Keller, the executive editor, and Frank Rich, an opinion columnist.
There is no doubt, ladies and gentlemen, that the Times has been unfair in its coverage of the Bush White House, and the paper also routinely uses personal attacks to hurt people with whom it disagrees. If that does not stop, Bill Keller and Frank Rich, to name the two main culprits, will not have a happy new year. As they say in the auction world, fair warning.
Later in the show, O'Reilly made it clear that he was talking about attacking Keller and Rich personally when Fox contributor Juan Williams asked him to clarify his previous statement.
If they continue, those people continue to attack people personally, as Frank Rich does almost every week and Keller allows it, then we'll just have to get into their lives. I don't want to do it. But I can't allow this stuff to go unchecked. I'm the only person on television that's going to hold these people accountable. The only one. Because everybody fears them. But both of those men have led lives. And if they want to attack people personally, Rich in print and Keller allowing it, then we're going to have to just show everybody about their lives.
Curiously, O'Reilly's reasoning seemed to have shifted in this explanation, directing the bulk of his ire at Rich for, quote, attacking people personally, close quote. Notice he makes no mention here of the Times' Bush coverage. Though O'Reilly's accusations against Rich are vague, readers of Rich's column will know that the Times writer takes occasional jabs at O'Reilly for things like his crusade against the war on Christmas and, oh yes, the sexual harassment case brought against O'Reilly by a former employee, which he settled out of court for millions of dollars after it became rather obvious that the employee had evidence in the form of tape recordings. If O'Reilly knows of similar ethical lapses on the part of either Rich or Keller, he should come forward with this information, rather than attempting to use it to blackmail these journalists on television.
And finally, media scholar and activist George Gerbner died on December 24th at the age of 86. He was dean emeritus of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. He was also the founder of the Cultural Indicators Project and the Cultural Environment Movement. Gerbner was also a friend and advisor to FAIR, which was a founding member organization of the Cultural Environment Movement. Gerbner's studies of television were invaluable to the understanding of how corporations, through broadcast media, have become central to modern cultural life and are, in many senses, usurping the roles that families and community institutions used to fulfill. Here is George Gerbner explaining this in a Counterspin appearance from January 9, 1997.
The basic problem is a great historic change. Human beings are the only animals that live in a world created by the stories we tell and the stories we hear. And today, most of the stories to most of our children, most of the time, are not told by the parent, or by the school, or by the church, or by the community, or even by the native country in most places around the world, but essentially by a handful of global conglomerates who really have nothing to tell but a great deal to sell.
Gerbner said that violence on television caused viewers to believe the world was more violent and dangerous than it actually was, what he called a mean world syndrome. He warned that this made citizens more passive, once writing, quote, "Fearful people are more dependent, more easily manipulated and controlled, more susceptible to deceptively simple, strong, tough measures and hardline postures. They may accept and even welcome repression if it promises to relieve their insecurities. That is the deeper problem of violence-laden television," close quote. Furthermore, Gerbner said that who controls power and violence, as portrayed on TV, and that would be mostly well-to-do white males, subtly informs women and minority viewers of their subordinate stature in society. George Gerbner, a leading scholar and activist in the media democracy movement, will be dearly missed.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
Though American reporting on Iraq is not all done through rose-colored glasses these days, much of it still holds out hope for victory or success or whatever the official word of the day is. This familiar coverage often features U.S. officials arguing that if they could just pull off one more election or produce a few more divisions of battle-ready Iraqi security forces, the whole thing could just still work out. Some journalists see it a little differently. On December 21st, reporter Patrick Coburn of the London-based Independent newspaper began his report like this, quote, "Iraq is disintegrating. The first results of the parliamentary election last week show the country is dividing between Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish regions," close quote. Patrick Coburn joins us now from London. Patrick Coburn, thanks for joining us again on Counterspin.
Good to be with you.
Well, contrary to the more or less positive view of the latest Iraq elections in the U.S., you wrote on December 21st, quote, "Religious fundamentalists now have the upper hand. The secular and nationalist candidate backed by the U.S. and Britain was humiliatingly defeated," close quote. And in your year-end roundup on December 30th, you described 2005 as, quote, "the ebb tide of American and British power in Iraq." Why is this so, in your view?
On the elections, I think it was all too clear, if you like, that the secular candidates were either doing badly or getting nowhere. Yet Alawi, the former prime minister, is likely to get only 25 seats, and Mehmed Chalabi, who used to be a chosen candidate of the U.S., got none at all. So it was really on all sides a triumph of the Shia or the Sunni religious parties, or in the north of the Kurdish parties. And there's really very little holding Iraq together at the moment.
Well, there's a view seldom mentioned here in the U.S. press, and that is the biggest winner in this Iraq adventure is Iran. With the political emergence of Shia religious figures, the possibility of Shia alliances, perhaps even a Shia superstate, including Iran and Shia Iraq. How do you see things shaking out in Iraq?
Well, I think it's got a long time to shake out because Iraq is such a fragmented country. There are so many tension points within Iraq. The winner in all this within the country is the Shia community. And the winner, the main winner outside, is Iran, which is, of course, also Shia by religion. And at the moment, we have, I think, certainly the U.S. officials in Iraq and in Washington not really facing up to the fact that the Shia won this election. There's talk of having a national government, but that would mean the Shia throwing power to those who did badly in the election. Now, whether we're speaking of Iraq or any country in the world, the number of people who won an election who were willing to give a lot of power to those who didn't get the votes is pretty limited.
Well, speaking of elections, you've mentioned the lack of basic services and electricity that is a daily occurrence in Iraq. You say that Iraqis often complain that it doesn't feel to them like they even have a government. We don't see that kind of coverage here. We don't see that kind of detail. Could this be because American reporters are generally not as in touch with everyday Iraqis, or they don't get out enough?
Well, I think there are American reporters who report just that. I'm not sure that it comes across on television so much because it's more difficult for them to get out and tell that story. I'm sort of astonished at times to read reports which give the impression that there is some improvement in Baghdad, which is the most violent city in the world, and in many ways the society there is disintegrating. You have most of the better off who have fled Iraq have moved to Jordan or Syria or Egypt. Even within the city, you have Shia moving from Sunni areas and vice versa. You have, sometimes I go and watch people picking up their children from school. And if people can't find their children immediately, they become terrified because they think they've been kidnapped. If you go down to the city morgue, you find there are 1,000 bodies a month turning up there, mostly shot, many of them tortured. Some have clearly been arrested by the police, but they still have handcuffs on the bodies. So I'm sort of amazed that anybody could see signs of improvement in present-day Baghdad.
Well, a point in the case that you just made, I think, is the day after your independent roundup was published, on December 30th, the Washington Post ran a report headlined, "Departing U.S. Commander Reports Progress in Baghdad. Webster cites fewer successful attacks, more Iraqi forces." Is it that U.S. journalists are just avoiding negative news?
I think they do report it, but it's normally about 6 months late. And the other thing is purely a physical difficulty to report in Iraq because of the danger of being kidnapped or shot. I've never reported anywhere where the insurgents completely ignore the media. They're not interested in presenting their case or talking to the media. That has left in the past an open field for Iraqi government or U.S. officials to give their own spin to what's happening. And that's why I think that it's been more difficult to report Iraq than any previous war. Now, I think I worked out that I'd covered 8 over the last 25 years. And it's easier for, let's say, in 2004, during the presidential election, for the administration to say that the situation in Iraq was improving, that most of the country was peaceful. You couldn't disprove that without getting yourself killed.
I gather from your reporting that you don't think there's many good options in the future of Iraq. Do you have any idea of what might be a less bad option, any prescription for what might help lift Iraq out of this this place that it's stuck in?
If one looks at the long term, I think that ending the occupation should be part of this. I mean, Iraq really suffers from three things, according to one senior Iraqi politician I was talking to: the occupation, corruption, and terrorism. And in many ways, each is as bad as the other. So long as you have foreign forces in the country, then they're going to be on one side or the other of the sectarian divide. It's generally unpopular. The insurgency is going to go on. But there is sort of an Iraqi government, so they should, an Iraqi government should negotiate the departure of foreign forces. And then also, since that's the main demand of the Sunni has been that the U.S. army should depart, that they should negotiate a ceasefire in return for a withdrawal of the occupation forces. But this isn't enough. When one says corruption, it sounds as though people are taking 15 or 20%. It isn't. It's the collapse of government. Government doesn't really do anything for Iraqis at the moment. For instance, when I look at the Iraqi army in the streets, you often see them riding along in old white pickups that are normally used for carrying cabbages or cauliflowers. The main reason for this is the entire procurement budget, $1.3 billion, was stolen over the last year. The whole lot has disappeared. So this is really a disintegration of government, which you normally associate with some of the states of Central Africa, of Congo or of Nigeria in the past. And you have to tackle those two problems, as well as tackling what's normally called terrorism, which includes both the sort of general insurrection, the general uprising, and the suicide bombers.
We've been speaking with Patrick Coburn, reporter for the London-based newspaper, The Independent. Patrick Coburn, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Not at all. Thank you.
A New York Times editorial claimed that the disastrous explosion at the Sago mine in West Virginia, quote, should focus us all on another forgotten, mistreated corner of society, close quote. To which one might want to respond, as did Jerry Isaacs at the World Socialist website, forgotten and mistreated by whom exactly? There are lessons to be taken away from the tragedy that claimed the lives of 12 miners, but to hear most reporters tell it, none of those lessons are about them. Our next guest contests that interpretation, saying that the initial misreporting of the number of survivors was not the only problem of mainstream media's coverage of the Sago explosion, and probably not even in the long term the most significant. Brian Dominick is a co-editor at the New Standard, an independent hard news website focusing on current events and investigative reporting. He joins us now by telephone from Syracuse, New York. Welcome to Counterspin, Brian Dominick.
Thanks, Janine.
Well, your piece about this focused on the other things that went wrong with the journalism around the Sago mine story, apart from this initial announcement that the miners had all been found alive. And I very much appreciate that. But especially since it seems like it right away became commonplace to hear, well, you can't blame media at all for that part. I wanted to talk a little bit anyway about what role the press did play there. Obviously, journalists weren't responsible for the miscommunication from underground. But is there really nothing for journalists to learn from that horrific mistake?
I think that that might still need to be the primary focus in terms of just actually what went wrong on scene. For sure, journalists could have done a much better job. I've long harped on the very concept of breaking news, and I find it inherently faulty. We don't do breaking news at the New Standard because, you know, 20, 30, 40% of it needs to be corrected later, and I find that unacceptable. Until we know something is true, I'm not sure how a journalist can really live with themselves for having stated it in a narrative voice like so many of the reporters did. They stopped even attributing it at a certain point. Both the original, you know, finding of supposedly 12 miners who have survived, that became narrative voice. That became a fact that was stated as if they hadn't heard it from someone third hand or from a bunch of people third hand. And I'm not quite sure how they really reach that point where they feel strongly that they can say, oh, now it's a fact.
Mm-hmm. As I was saying, it's not media's fault maybe that the family members were misinformed, but it certainly is their fault that the entire country was. But you're
exactly
suggesting that that kind of is par for the course with this kind of tight focus, hair trigger approach, that the problem is inherent in that very approach to collecting news.
Yeah, well, I happened to be watching CNN when two different people at two different points, both points where the story changed dramatically, ran up to Anderson Cooper, and I believe on both occasions he was the first reporter to sort of relay the message. But what he did was he just put a mic in someone whose names he didn't even know, put in their face and let them announce on live television, you know, broadcast around the world, what a fact was. about this dramatic story. And it would occur to me that that would be the time that a producer would say, okay, we got to cut away. We're going to do some verification here. We can't just have random people running up and giving the news. And instead, what Cooper did was reply, oh, that's amazing. That's incredible. Wow, I can't believe this. This is a fact. So I did the exact opposite response of what I would have had if I were the reporter on the scene.
Well, let's move on and talk about some of the other problems of the coverage that were certainly got less attention even than that one, but that you found significant.
To us at the New Standard, when this story came across, we don't look at stories as public fascination stories. We look at them as public interest stories. And it occurs to me that at least some segment of the media needs to uphold public interest. We need to look at something and say, how does this impact the public? Not how is this interesting to the public. And what most of the media did was they focused on what are the most interesting aspects of the story, the drama of it. To us, it was very clear because we do what we think a lot of media should do, which is workplace safety coverage. You know, what are the problems that workers face? What are the problems that everyday people face in terms of health and safety in a society? And that's what this story triggered. So that seemed to us to be the exact angle to approach this from. Sure, people want to know whether these 13 people are alive or dead, but surely the real public interest here is, what does this story say about mine safety? What does this story say about workplace safety? And that seemed to be nowhere in the immediate coverage.
We did start to hear after the fact that there was a long history of violations at this mine. You're suggesting that after the fact is too late to wait for that sort of information, that in fact, if you can make that more than a sidebar while the story was unfolding, that that might have even changed the story, perhaps.
I think it would have changed the focus of who we're really looking at. It seemed that the media and the company, the International Coal Group, just sort of cozied up immediately and became a team in expressing and in sharing information here. And I'm not sure that really a situation where a corporation that had a mine that was in the shape that this one was, that was as dangerous as this one was, and is, of course, going to face massive lawsuits, possibly, you know, all sorts of violations as a result of this, should necessarily even be the main source of information. Shouldn't the media take a slightly more antagonistic or at least skeptical approach? And I think if they'd seen the record of this company and the record of this mine early on and focused on that, maybe they would have seen a little bit more reason to be skeptical of all the information that they were being fed. But beyond that, it's not just this mine. And it's the laws, it's what the Bush administration has done in the last 5 years to reduce workplace safety laws. Almost none of that has even made it into the media, even to this day. So there was a lot of after the fact, look at how bad this mine was. But what about the fact that this mine remained open after all this? What about the things that might be wrong with this mine that weren't violations? What about the fact that there were all these citations that because of the way the system was set up, the penalties were minuscule? So I think that the media needs to step back even farther and say, are there problems with the system, not just were there problems with this mine?
In a piece on the Huffington Post on January 4th, Murray Wass noted that it's kind of becoming fashionable for journalists to emote on television. And he said that, you know, what better way to dispel the belief that the media are entrenched in a privileged interest group than with a little emoting and yelling. And his quote was, but there are a few problems with this new media paradigm. Being outraged after the fact, for instance, is not the same as journalists doing their jobs. I wanted to ask you what you make of this notion in general, that reporters are all of a sudden mad as hell and aren't going to take it anymore. Does that have any reality outside of journalists' own minds?
Well, this, of course, started with Katrina. Mm-hmm. We saw it every day while the CNN and Fox reporters, you know, where we see it most dramatically is with the television reporters.
Right.
And all of a sudden, they became what has long been considered advocacy journalists. And what we saw there was them saying, okay, well, there is a right and wrong, and we don't have to report from a purely objective perspective. What is wrong is that these people are trapped here, in that case, trapped here in New Orleans during the flooding, people dying, et cetera, and that was wrong, and that what would be good would be for them to be saved, right? And so then all of a sudden it became okay to take a stance. And I'm not sure what happened in their minds. I don't even want to get in their minds. But what that did do was open a door. I would like to think that it opened a door for journalists to look at things and say that there is a right and wrong, and that you can report things from an angle of it would be good if, you know, it would be good if there were fewer wars in the world. It would be good if people weren't starving. All sorts of things like that, where today, in today's environment, journalists and the mainstream media are supposed to be afraid to, it isn't whether they express their emotions or not, it's to express that they might even have a feeling one way or the other about things like starvation or about things like war. And that's where I think that there could be a breakthrough. But whether this actually indicates that there's anything like that, I'm not sure. I think that some of them got caught up in their emotions and it was actually applauded, as maybe it should be, because it looked like, for a second, they were actually taking stands against horrible things, things that were horrible in almost anybody's mind. What it means for the future of journalism, I'm not quite sure, but it is something I'd like to see people latching onto in a productive direction.
Well, let me ask you finally, just very quickly, about this particular story. On the World Socialist website, Jerry Isaacs pointed out how CNN reporter Kira Phillips on January 4th was already urging the governor of West Virginia's wife to explain how she was encouraging family members and others to stay in the business and, quote, tell them how important it is, alongside the dangers, just to keep the economy going and surviving as a very important industry in your state, close quote. It sort of sounds as though post-tragedy media are going right back to their role of looking out for the companies, which requires portraying Sago as an aberration.
Yeah, absolutely. And they need to romanticize something. I mean, to the extent as the media wants to portray it, working in mines is a cultural phenomenon. It's one that arose out of economic necessity. And I'm not sure how much respect that's going to get in the near future, even if it did for a couple days.
I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. We've been speaking with Brian Dominick. He's a co-editor at the hard news website, The New Standard. You can find them online at newstandardnews.net. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
It was my pleasure, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.